journalism is to question the prevailing wisdom. Question the prevailing wisdom.
Just speak the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
All rights reserved and affirmed.
Free all minds. These are weapons of mass descent.
These are weapons of mass descent.
Welcome to Uprising, a daily digest of independent news analysis, investigation, education, artistic expression, and activism. It's Friday, June 24th, 2011. Sitting in for Sonali Kohatkar, I'm your host, Deinmore Santhararajan.
It just makes me stop and think. Silence is not an option.
North Carolina confronts its dark history with forced sterilization. And part two of Rana Husseini's interview on the fight against honor killings. Also, an interview with the director of the new documentary, Crime After Crime. Plus this week's edition of Rethink Reviews.
This is Uprising.
Good morning and welcome to Uprising. A 14-year-old is raped, and upon giving birth, her illiterate grandmother unknowingly signs away her granddaughter's right to ever have another child. North Carolina then forcibly sterilized this teenager, and she wouldn't realize it until years later. This story, according to CBS News, is one of many from women who are victims of a dark period in U.S. medical history. Some 60,000 women in 32 states were victims of forced state-imposed sterilization. They were commonly young, poor, and women who were the state deemed promiscuous or feeble-minded. Time magazine reports that North Carolina sterilized over 7,000 girls from 1929 through the 1970s. It is the first state to consider financially compensating victims of this practice. However, it's next to impossible to put a dollar amount on the suffering imposed on victims of this practice. Payments of $20,000 each are being proposed, costing the state about $69 million in payments to all survivors. Joining us now on the phone is Loretta Ross, founding member and national coordinator of Sister Song, a woman of color reproductive justice collective. Welcome to Uprising, Loretta.
Thanks for having me on your show.
Good morning. Now, what is the significance of the development in North Carolina?
Well, it's very important for the state to acknowledge that the women's human rights were violated. It is not the job of the state to say who shall and shall not have children. That's actually a crime against humanity that's covered under the Convention Against Genocide and Torture. And so it's really important for them to take this step and acknowledge the harm that has been done, the wrong that has been done, and then to offer to compensate the women. So no amount of money will make things right. I myself was sterilized when I was 23. So you can never count the opportunities you were denied because of someone else's decision about your reproduction.
I did not know that you were a survivor, Loretta. That's pretty incredible. Well, I think that what's really important, and, you know, when I encountered the story, I was pretty shocked because I knew about the American history of sterilization in its territories. I didn't know that it had happened in the United States and to the scale that it had happened. Can you tell us a little bit of this history and how it became popular along with eugenics with communities most vulnerable to this practice?
Well, it actually, at the turn of the century, after Darwin had done his theories, people started to talk about how they could breed a better human being. And, of course, they used a very racist caste or analysis, figuring out that they wanted to breed more white people and actually discourage or inhibit the breeding of those they deemed undesirable. So they used both positive eugenics, things like free child care and, you know, family leave and stuff to encourage white people to have more children, and then negative incentives or negative eugenics like the forced sterilization, incarceration, deportation of immigrants in order to keep what they deemed undesirables from populating the United States. So eugenics has skewed the population numbers in the history of this country since the turn of the century, even getting the endorsement of people like national presidents and, you know, mainstream Americans. It was very much a common practice What's been interesting about the reports is the number of nurses and social workers who were participating in that practice, who are now saying that they felt that they were doing the right thing, that they were doing what they thought was best for the women, when in fact it is not their right to decide what is best for other people. Again, when you have a population that seeks to control the destiny of another population, you end up with these ugly stories.
I'm speaking with Loretta Ross, founding member and national coordinator of Sister Song. And we're discussing today North Carolina's recent confrontation and admission of its forced sterilization program. And I was going to ask, going back into this, what do you think is the legacy of forced sterilization within families and communities?
Well, first of all, it's made communities of color deeply distrustful of the medical profession. We're not always sure if our interests are at the top of their mind when they offer us medical advice, particularly when you couple it with the horrific legacy of the Tuskegee experiment, where untreated syphilis was allowed to run rampant in a study of black men, which also infected women, by the way, who never got treatment or got studied. And so it creates this legacy of medical mistrust. And then that gets exploited by the anti-abortion movement with those billboards that they're putting around the country claiming that abortion is racist, because then they can use this distrust and this bad legacy to claim that black women and Latinos should never be in charge of our own reproduction, that someone else should be looking out for our interests. But we understand what happens when someone else looks out for our interests. It removes our human right to decide for ourselves if and when to have children.
Well, and the historical record is pretty damning. Like, in preparing for this segment, I was reading some of the quotes by Oliver Wendell Holmes, and he was a Supreme Court justice that voted in favor of the eugenics policies. And one of the quotes he had was that three generations of imbeciles was enough. What's your reaction to that? And what's your reaction to the historical record, not only of the states, but also of the United States government, because it was a national policy?
Well, the sad part is that that kind of thinking is not only buried deep in history. We have a Louisiana legislator who wants to sterilize women who receive welfare today. He has promoted a bill in Louisiana to forcibly sterilize poor women. And so eugenical thinking is not just a thing of the past. It infects public policy discussions today around people who believe they have the right to tell other people what to do with their bodies and their lives. And so it was much more mainstream back then, but it's certainly on the margins of thinking about reproductive politics and reproductive justice today.
Well, I was going to ask, in light of that, how do you feel like the attitudes of that allowed forced sterilization are really kind of at the forefront in terms of the redefinition, not only in terms of this question of sterilization, but really about the larger questions of reproductive health for women, and especially in the current efforts to redefine rape?
Well, I think that we have racism and sexism and homophobia and all kinds of things guiding and contaminating public policy discussions. And for the House to even talk about whether or not a woman is truly raped if no force is exerted, if she is simply coerced, as they put it, they are really doing a frontal assault on the human rights of women in this country, and they're doing it with impunity. They don't seem to feel shame when they accuse rape victims of victimizing the perpetrators, when they accuse poor women of victimizing the system, when they accuse immigrants of exploiting the system. They seem to feel fairly shameless, and that's why we have to mount such a strong human rights movement to fight back against these interlocked oppressions that affect us in myriad ways, but we don't necessarily have a united movement to fight them together, and that's what we have to build.
Mm. And in terms of this specific case, is there a national movement to get justice for the victims of these forced sterilizations, and what do you know of in terms of campaigns and that sort?
I read in the newspaper reports that there was a local committee in North Carolina that was pushing for the state legislature to compensate the victims. I'm not aware of a national movement specifically against sterilization abuse, though, of course, those of us in the reproductive justice movement have that as one of our core values, because a woman does have the right to have a child and to have that child under the conditions of her choice, using midwives or doulas and things like that. And I think that's what separates reproductive rights from the pro-choice movement, I mean reproductive justice from the pro-choice movement, because we really focus on the right to have and to parent children in a way that the pro-choice movement tends to underemphasize.
Well, and it feels like, you know, beyond there being a restitution of justice, I mean, the restitution economically seems pretty crucial because, I mean, I was going to ask in your own experience, the kinds of sterilizations that they did, do you feel like they were done in a healthful way? Were there lasting health impacts for the women? Like, what do you know of that situation and what was your own experience with that?
Well, I was sterilized at 23, so I entered menopause at 25. And so I've been dealing with menopausal symptoms now for close to 40 years. And the hormone replacement therapies that were offered to me, I considered at the time quite dangerous because the doctor told me I would have to take them until my natural menopause cycle would occur in my 50s. And I literally told him, there's no way I would take this pill for 40 years. I wouldn't even take aspirin for 40 years. And then I was proven right because now HRT therapies have been shown to lead to increased breast and uterine cancer. So even though I wasn't well informed, I made the right decision. So I think those women probably dealt with symptoms very similar to mine, premature menopause, probably weight gain, all the things that go along with menopause that is not unusual in a woman in her 50s and 60s, but is a tragedy when you start menopause as a teenager.
Right, because some of the victims were 13, 14. I think the youngest recorded was like 10. I didn't actually know a lot about forced sterilization, but as soon as that procedure happens, your body basically is in a menopausal state for the rest of its life, correct?
Because they remove your ovaries, and your ovaries produce estrogen, which is necessary for hormonal balance. And so you get an overproduction of testosterone. And I'm not a doctor. I'm just a living example.
You're just a survivor.
And so you end up dealing with a lot of health symptoms, like vaginal dryness and all kinds of things that simply are abnormal for a person of that age, and they're having to adjust that. And then let's deal with the mental and the psychological cost of not being able to control your life, not being able to have the children or the grandchildren that you wanted to have. Who knows what those women suffered through? But the saddest part about the story that I read was that she didn't know.
Right.
So all of this would have been happening to her, and she didn't even know what was happening until another doctor told her, well, you no longer are able to have children. You were sterilized. And I'm not sure if she got any counseling at that moment to deal with that, whether or not she had been in counseling trying to cope with the sense of loss and the physiological changes that were happening in her body. No one apparently was there for her who could give her information about what was going on. And that I'm not sure the state can ever compensate her for.
No, absolutely. And I mean, with this North Carolina state situation, the other thing that was pretty condemning and why there's a very strong case for state restitution was that very private donors were a big push behind this, particularly the heir to the Procter & Gamble fortune. And there's over 60,000 women across the country that have been victims of this sterilization movement, many of whom don't actually come out because of the shame and the fear. And, you know, while this is all the time we have for this segment, I definitely want, if any of those women are listening now or people that want to get involved or learn more about the reproductive justice rights movement, I want to be able to leave them with the website and a connection to a larger movement. Loretta, can you give out your website?
Yes, we're at sistersong.net. That's sistersong.net. And we're having our national conference call, Let's Talk About Sex, July 14th through 17th in Miami. And we invite everyone who's listening who would like to come talk more about these issues, as well as other reproductive health challenges that we have in communities of color, to join us. And the website, again, is sistersong.net.
All right. Thank you so much, Loretta. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me on your show.
I've been speaking with Loretta Ross, founding member and national coordinator of Sister Song, a woman of color reproductive justice collective. You can read more about their work at www.sistersong.net. Later in the hour, we'll talk to the director of Crime After Crime, a documentary film about the battle to free Debbie Pegler, an incarcerated woman's fight against prosecutorial misconduct by the L.A. District Attorney. But up next, a recorded interview that Sonali Kohatkar did with Rana Husseini about her book, Murder in the Name of Honor. Stay tuned.
The third annual Los Angeles Anarchist Book Fair will take place Saturday, June the 25th, from 11 a.m. to 6 p.m. That's all going down at ArtShare LA, located at 801 East 4th Place in Los Angeles. The Los Angeles Anarchist Book Fair Collective brings together anarchist ideas through the dissemination of books, arts, film, and more. And we hope to provide a space where we can facilitate discussions, skill sharing workshops, presentations, children activities, and spontaneous caucuses to provide an open space for those interested in anti-authoritarian ideas and how they're being applied in the 21st century. That's the third annual Los Angeles Anarchist Book Fair, taking place on Saturday, June the 25th, from 11 a.m. to 6 p.m. More information is available at 323-978-3322 or on the web at kpfk.org. KPFK is a proud media sponsor.
Welcome back to Uprising. Sitting in for Sonali Kohatkar, I'm your host, Thane Mori Soundararajan. I just want to remind our listeners that tomorrow's Anarchist Book Fair features much more than books. There will be workshops, panels on topics, including organizing in the fast food industry, anarchist organizing in universities, and the current economic crisis in California. Panels will be led by Native youth and elders on protecting the land. Featured authors include Fred Hampton and Jeffrey Haas. It all takes place at ArtShare LA at 801 East 4th Place in Los Angeles. Tomorrow, Saturday, June 25th, from 11 a.m. to 6 p.m. And KPFK is, of course, a proud media sponsor. And now for our next segment. Yesterday, we heard part one of a two-part interview with Jordanian journalist and feminist Rana Husseini about her new book, Murder in the Name of Honor, the true story of one woman's heroic fight against an unbelievable crime. Every year, an estimated 5,000 women are killed by so-called crimes of honor. It is a practice that links a woman's sexuality and often virginity to the honor of her family, an entire community. For more than 15 years, Rana Husseini has worked to uncover the stories of violence against women and has helped to veer both legal and cultural traditions away from this barbaric practice. Her work has led her to discover that so-called honor killings happen all over the world, contrary to the belief that they are restricted to the Arab and Muslim world. In countries like Italy, the UK, Brazil, and right here in the United States, violence against women, stemming from jealousy, male entitlement, family honor, and other patriarchal structures, is far more prevalent than most of us realize. Today we play part two of Sonali Kohatkar's 2009 interview with Rana Husseini.
From reading your book, you get the sense that there is this interesting tension between the idea among, you know, communities that condone honor killings, that it's okay to murder a woman for honor crimes. But there's a tension between that with between that and a sort of denial that it even happens? Because one would think that if people think it's honorable to kill women for these crimes, they should be proud of it. But then there's also this denial that this doesn't happen in Jordanian society or wherever, in any other country. There's this attempt to try to hide it, although, as you said, it is coming out so much more now. Have you seen that dynamic change a lot more, where people are now so much more willing to say, okay, it does happen, and we do want to fix it?
True. I mean, because of our what we did, all the activities that happened in Jordan, this is what we're seeing now. People are more aware. As I said, you know, like one of the things in the 90s, we pushed the government to admit there's a problem. When I first started, if people went and asked the government, oh, we only have 3 or 4 cases. When we did our activities in the late 90s, okay, we have 12. You know, in Jordan, the average is between 20 to 25. So, okay, we have 12, 13 cases. Now they are talking about real figures, the government itself. Mm-hmm. Is talking about, even the Queen Rania, spoke in an interview recently about 20 to 25 women being killed. The Minister of Justice announced the same figures.
Per year.
The government, yeah. So, you know, you have now people who are acknowledging this. I mean, when the government acknowledges there's a problem, you can hold them accountable. But now they are working, they are doing things. On the other hand, I used to go and lecture when I started about this issue, and I've been lecturing forever, and I repeat myself over and over and over because I believe that this is how you raise awareness, and this is how you change attitudes, and this is how you help women who are in need. And in the beginning, I would have men who would say, oh, they would raise their hand, I would kill my sister if she did something wrong, you know, so what? Now I see more when I go and lecture, there are more men who are standing up. We have to do something. Even young men who are excited, you know, they send me emails. They get involved in activities, you know, that is related to this, and they want to do something. And I had an open lecture 2 years ago. I didn't know who my audience were, and I had 2 men who stood up separately, and each of them was telling me, I know that killing my sister is not right. Help us. What can we do to avoid this problem? Even now, there's more men involved in drama work, interactive theater. They're addressing this issue. They're trying to talk to people. They go around to talk about. There is a lot of movement, and that's why I document a lot of what happened in Jordan, because I think Jordan is a very successful, we had a very successful experience. Of course, unfortunately, the crimes are still happening, but awareness has increased dramatically from the time I started until now, and things are changing. And when things start change, you see there is hope, and this is usually the healthy thing that happens.
Rana, you talk about the anger you feel or you felt when you came across the men who had killed their sisters or other female relatives. And your example is a very powerful one of transforming anger into action. But talk about that anger that you felt when you first started digging into these stories and how you forced yourself to hold back.
Well, you know, to be honest with you, every time I hear of a story, I get so angry. I get so frustrated. I feel that, my God, we're not doing enough. We have to do more. It's really, really frustrating. And as I said, you know, when I first started writing, it was a shock to me, because I've never, you know, in my surroundings or my area even, I've never heard of a woman being killed for reasons related to family honor. I studied here in the U.S. for 6 years, and I went back to Jordan. I was assigned as the crime reporter. When I was going back, I said I wanted to do things for women in Jordan, but I did not know what it was. I never even imagined that I was going to be in this topic. And then when this story of Kifaya came, and I think that it was my fate to be the person to write about this, to be the person to advocate about this. It was just a small item I read. I said I have to go and investigate, and I came up with this horrific story. It's really frustrating. It's really anger. It's, you know, you feel that there's a lot that you have to do. There's a lot of, unfortunately, backward thinking, a lot of things that you have to fight. But I mean, at the end of the day, the most rewarding thing is now you see change. And this is something very important. And that's why in my book, I want people to know that there is hope. If they work, if they believe in what they're doing, if they are consistent, it's very important to be consistent. It's not, that's why I keep saying, you have to constantly, I was documenting each and every case the same manner for the past 16 years. And I know a lot of people, and I don't only cover so-called honor crimes, I also cover regular murders, I cover accidents, disasters, courts. So a lot of people say, how can you live with this? And what I do is I do a lot of activities, I'm very active, I go out, I go with friends, listen to music, watch movies, play
try to
cards.
Keep your sanity.
I'm an athletic person. So I do a lot of things to try.
You're on
to,
the basketball team.
Yeah, I'm
in
on the basketball team. I'm also in charge of a women's soccer team in Jordan. I'm in charge of the women's program now. And, you know, I do many activities. And sometimes some stories, to be honest, they stay with me for a while. But eventually, I just put them behind my back and just go on.
You mentioned that you've been accused of being a Western agent, and this is a common accusation for human rights defenders outside of the U.S. and the Western world. And you know, how does somebody like yourself struggle with that? Because so many progressive people here in the United States often fall into that trap. And these are people who could be and ought to be your allies. But they see your work sometimes, or the work like yours, as feeding into justifications given by the State Department for U.S. military occupations in countries like Afghanistan, for example, or Pakistan, Iraq, not Saudi Arabia, right? Because we have double standards. Sometimes liberal groups in the U.S. feed into that same kind of accusation.
Well, this is an accusation that I've been living with since I started being a Western agent, being a Zionist agent.
Oh, there you go.
Of course.
I've heard that.
Yeah, of course. Radical feminist. I was accused of everything you can imagine. I'm seeking fame and all that. First of all, I don't care for what others say about me because I have strong faith in what I'm doing. I'm not doing anything right. I'm not contradicting any religion. I'm not contradicting any human rights conventions or beliefs or values. I don't need anyone from the West to come and tell me that killing a woman is not right. I have a brain. I can think to myself. It's nice if you have support from the West and from your own country. And I've received support from the West and from my country and from other countries all over the world. People can say whatever they want. I mean, I cannot sit there and be afraid of what somebody might say of me or my culture and then have women being killed just because I'm afraid of what this person would do or what that person will make use of this. This issue was used by many people, not only by the State Department. There was this woman who wrote a book, a fake book about Jordan. This book came just before the war in Iraq, and it really fed to what the West wanted to hear about the East at that time, that they are all evil men, they deserve to be killed, they deserve to launch a war against them. And her book was a bestseller. I fought to expose this book because it was really horrific.
What was the book called?
It's what's called Honor Lost in the U.S., and the writer was Norma Khoury, and she wrote this fake story. And, you know, she pictured life in Jordan as if even before the Prophet's time, as if women are all oppressed. It was really insulting to all women in Jordan. It was insulting to Christians in Jordan because she said women, Christians have to pay taxes. They could not build higher buildings than Muslims. You know, all these stupid details that, unfortunately, the West believes it. And they feed on it. And I was receiving hundreds of emails from people trashing us as a nation and as Arabs and Muslims and saying you're barbarics. And, you know, it's really horrible. And she went to Australia to lecture on the need to liberate Arab and Muslim women. So, unfortunately, I agree with you. The issue of women does get used by governments in the West, but it's not my problem. I've been fighting for this for the past 16 years. I would never predict that the U.S. would launch a war in Iraq and they would, or Afghanistan, or and they would use such arguments. I've been doing it since 1993, and at that time there was really nothing going on. And I will still do it. I'm not afraid if they want to use it. That's why I have my book, because the book tells truth. It tells realities. It tells what societies are doing. It tells that this is an international problem. It's not a problem that is restricted to a certain country. And we have seen really what kind of liberation they have offered for women. In Afghanistan, in Pakistan, you see the situation is going really, really backward. In Iraq, it's horrible. The government there is drafting laws to take rights from women. So I really do not see where is the liberation that the U.S. State Department talked about.
If anything, it's as though women have a much worse life after U.S. occupation than before.
Exactly. Unfortunately, I really wish that things would change for women all over these conflict areas and they will have more rights. Hmm. But as I see it now, it's really bad. In Iraq, they really complain about... there's a section about Iraq in my book. Women activists there complain of rights being stripped from them. Although the government is supported by the U.S., the Iraqi government, women being killed just because they are women, women being killed because they walk in the street, some of them they are not covered, and some of them because they are activists or government officials. And you've heard stories of women who were assassinated. So really, there is nothing that was liberated. On the contrary, everything is going backwards.
Rana Hosseini, finally, do you think that it's going to take action from both the grassroots and government levels, or do you put your faith more in people power?
I think everything should help. Mm-hmm. In this specific issue, in violence against women, violence against children, everyone has to work on this issue.
So on all levels?
All levels, because the government is the government draft laws that protect women and children and protect their rights, okay? And they can offer services. You know, you can't always depend on the civil society. I mean, in Jordan, we've been calling for a women's shelter for the longest time. And they were supposed to open one in 1997. It took them around 10 years to open the first government-run. Now it's called Family Reconciliation Center, not a shelter, because the terminology, it was very sensitive, and they didn't want to use it. But at least now there is a place for women, abused women, to go to. If she goes to police, they can refer her there. In the past, the police would tell her, go home, we cannot help you, go back to your husband.
Or put her in jail.
Yeah. I mean, we have two NGOs that were helping these women, but they are like, they do not have the means, they do not have the capability as much as the government, you know, that can support and beef up this center with everything that you would need: security, psychological assistance, social assistance, even money, even, you know, a place to stay at. And this is the government's responsibility. Mm. You cannot always depend on NGOs. It has to come from everyone. I truly believe the media, civil society, the government, the leaders in the community, even if we can find to humanize the stories. One of the problems, as I said, you know, okay, this woman was killed. Who is this woman? Nobody knows. You have to give her a name. You have to give her. Unfortunately, we cannot give her a picture or a name because it's against the press and publications law, but at least try to talk about as details as much as possible. Also try to get men involved. It's very important to get men involved. Women fighting alone, it's not going to, okay, you can do it, but it's not, if you have men beside you, it's much better to gain them beside you rather than have them fighting you. If you can find a family or a man who killed his sister in the past and regretted it, this would be a person that, and, you know, he can go out and speak on that level.
And do you know of such men?
There is this man I interviewed mm-hmm. in my book, and I actually use his words to show that he really never wanted to kill his sister, that he was pressured. I truly think that some of these men who killed, they are victims of the surroundings. They are victim of their social, wrongful social cultures and traditions, their families, their surroundings, that puts them in this situation. You have to kill. If you don't kill, people will look down on us.
And sometimes these are sort of assignments given to
exactly.
these male relatives.
And, you know,
it's your responsibility to do it.
Unfortunately, the society turns these normal human beings into killers.
Mm. Well, best of luck to you, Rana Hosseini, and thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to part two of Sonali Kohatkar's 2009 interview with Jordanian author and activist Rana Hosseini about her book Murder in the Name of Honor. Later in the hour, we'll talk to Yoav Potash, director of the new documentary Crime After Crime, called A Riveting Examination of Justice Denied by the Salt Lake Tribune. But first, this week's edition of Rethink Reviews with Jonathan Kim.
I'm Jonathan Kim, and this is Rethink Reviews, where we take a deeper look at current and past films and how they relate to the world today.
I don't want you to miss school no more. School's important. It's everything.
Oh, see, professor?
See, professor? You want to end up like me?
No.
After Chris Weitz finished directing the latest Twilight sequel, he could have chosen to make any film he wanted. But instead of some mega-budget sci-fi fantasy, Weitz used his cachet to make a movie honoring his Mexican roots from a screenplay that had been languishing for 25 years. That movie is A Better Life, which puts a human face on the millions of illegal immigrants who we rely on every day to feed us, build and maintain our homes, and take care of our children by telling the story of an undocumented gardener, played by the Mexican star Demian Bashir, and the lengths he'll go to in order to provide a future for his American-born teenage son. Bashir plays Carlos, who's been living illegally in Los Angeles for years. He works tirelessly as a gardener, maintaining the yards of LA's wealthy, until he returns to his small house to sleep on the couch in his clothes, allowing his son, Luis, played by newcomer Jose Julian, to use the house's only bedroom. Luis, who looks down on his father and has been growing apart from him for years, has been slacking at school and is increasingly feeling the pull of LA's Latino gangs, especially from his best friend, played by Bobby Soto, and Luis's girlfriend, played by Chelsea Rendon, whose family is largely made up of gang members. But when Carlos's boss offers to sell Carlos his pickup truck, he sees an opportunity to own his own business and make enough money to move to a neighborhood with better schools. But soon after Carlos buys the truck using a big loan from his sister, it gets stolen, leading to what sometimes feels like a detective or crime thriller playing out in slow motion, as Carlos and Luis traverse the Mexican neighborhoods of Los Angeles by bus to track down the truck. While the objectives in crime thrillers are often suitcases full of cash, car trunks full of drugs, or a murderer on the loose, the stakes in A Better Life feel like they couldn't be higher, with the stolen truck representing Carlos's last chance to save his son from jail or an early death, where the most minor brush with the law could cause Carlos to be deported back to Mexico and separated from Luis. But at its heart, A Better Life is the story of a father's love for his son, which shines through every moment of Bashir's powerful performance, as Carlos and Luis's quest to find the truck gives them a chance to spend the kind of time together that Carlos's long hours haven't allowed. In the process, Luis learns valuable lessons about his roots, as well as what it means to be a father and how to treat people with respect.
I wanted you to be able to be anything you wanted to be. That would make me feel worthy.
Filmed at over 70 locations across Los Angeles, A Better Life also provides a glimpse into the lives of Mexican Americans and illegal immigrants, including a Mexican rodeo, an apartment converted to a makeshift dorm for undocumented workers, and a home where gang members are raising their families. At a time when Republicans are attempting to demonize and scapegoat illegal immigrants for America's problems, A Better Life reveals the truth that so many immigrants and their descendants, including myself, already know. That immigrants, legal or not, are perhaps the purest reflection of the American dream, which isn't to become a millionaire, but to improve the lives of their families through hard work. A Better Life is a moving, beautiful film that I've thought of often since seeing it, and it should be required viewing for Republicans, who should be asked if they would act differently from Carlos if the future of their children was at stake. A Better Life is rated PG-13 and opens today in New York and Los Angeles. So if you live there, please see it opening weekend to help A Better Life get the wider distribution it deserves. I'm Jonathan Kim, and this is a Rethink Review for Uprising.
Thank you so much, Jonathan. You're listening to Uprising, sitting in for Sonali Kohatkar. I'm your host, Thane Mori, Soundararajan. Women make up the fastest-growing segment of the American prison population. The number of women incarcerated in the United States has increased tenfold, from about 11,000 in 1977 to 120,000 by 2010. A staggering 80% of incarcerated women are survivors of domestic violence, rape, and other forms of abuse. A new documentary film, Crime After Crime, explores the double injustice visited upon this demographic through the story of Debbie Pegler. Pegler, a young woman from South Central LA, was incarcerated in 1983 for the murder of Oliver Wilson, her brutally abusive partner. Pegler did not kill Wilson, but prosecutors argued that she arranged a murder for hire in pursuit of life insurance money. At that time of Debbie Pegler's trial in the early 80s, there were no mitigating circumstance rules that allowed the judicial system to take domestic violence into account when sentencing women for the murder of intimate partners. In 2002, a law passed in California that allowed the courts to revisit the cases of women who say the violent crimes they were convicted of could be directly linked to domestic violence. A duo of volunteer attorneys stepped up to help Pegler gain her freedom through this law. What they uncovered over years of legal battles was not only the complicated, sympathetic life story of Debbie Pegler, but after repeated instances of misconduct by the LA District Attorney's Office. Crime After Crime follows Debbie and her attorney's journey through all the emotional highs and lows of that fight. The Washington Post called the film harrowing, moving, and inspiring. Crime After Crime is screening at the LA Film Festival this Saturday, June 25th at 8 p.m. at Grand Performances on California Plaza. We are very pleased to have in studio with us the director of this amazing film, Yoav Potash. Welcome to Uprising, Yoav.
Hi, how you doing?
Now, before we begin, let's listen to a clip from the film Crime After Crime. Here, Debbie and her attorney explain how Debbie's relationship with Oliver slid into one of pimp and prostitute, abuser, and victim.
Debbie Pegler was 15 when she first met Oliver Wilson. In fact, her mother introduced her to Oliver.
He seemed to know that the way to my heart is through my children. And that's how he won me over, by being good to Debbie at the very beginning and accepting my granddaughter. Like she was his child.
We'd go out to eat, or he'd take me to the mall, shopping.
just buy me anything I wanted. Money was like never an object, never a problem with him. It never dawned on me, he is not making this money from working at ABC Market, but I was young and kind of naive and didn't know anything about it. Until one night, he said, I want to take you somewhere special. And I was like, oh, okay. So I'm thinking it's going to be a really nice restaurant or another concert, because he's taken me to a concert before. He introduced me to the two women, and then he left. And they told me where to go, what room to take a man to, how long to be in there, what to let the man do, what not to let him do, and how much to charge him, and all this stuff. And I'm like freaking out. I'm like, what do you mean? I'm not going to have sex with that man. I don't know that man. And they said, oh, baby, yes, you are. Yes, you are. You're going to make your man some money. And the man's like, don't you know what's going to happen if you don't do this? Nothing's going to happen. Nothing's going to happen. I don't know. Your pimp's gonna beat you, and he's gonna do this, and he's describing all this horrendous stuff. I'm like, no, Oliver would never do that to me. Oh no. Little did I know, yes he would, and yes he did, because I didn't go through with it. And when he came back to get me, he was like, well, how much money did you make? I was like, none. What do you mean none? I said, I'm not gonna do that. I don't want to do that. No, I don't. And said, oh, okay. Like nothing was wrong. And then we went to his mother's house. Next thing I know, he hauled up and slapped the crap out of me. I just balled up on the floor in a ball. Never forget, he was just kicking me and kicking me and kicking me. And I was like, okay, I promise. I'll do it, I'll do it next time. I promise. Just please don't hit me no more. Please just stop hitting me.
Oliver continued to abuse and force Debbie to prostitute herself throughout her sophomore, junior, and senior years of high school. That was from the opening minutes of the new documentary film, Crime After Crime. Listeners should know we edited that together with those 2 minutes from a much longer 20 minutes or so of heart-wrenching and revealing interviews with Debbie, her family, and the family of Oliver Wilson. Yoav, what drew you to tell Debbie's story?
Debbie herself. When I first met her, you know, she was incarcerated, of course, at a maximum security prison. And I knew that she had been through hell. And she told me her experience, which you've just heard in part. So I knew she had been essentially tricked and horribly abused for years, prostituted, and really denied her freedom as a human being, and then been denied justice. Because she was cornered into taking a guilty plea because her only other choice was to risk the death penalty. So she had been sent to prison for all these years. And yet despite all of that, despite everything she had been through, she was an uplifting, inspiring person to be around. She was leading the gospel choir inside the prison, teaching other inmates to read and write. Really doing everything she could to make the most of her life despite the very bad hand she had been dealt. So to me, that was very attractive as a filmmaker, someone who really could hold their head up high despite all of these circumstances. So, you know, I was hooked from meeting her.
Mm-hmm. And I think that Debbie is a very complex and compelling character. And one of the things I got from watching your film was that justice is there for even the complex, you know, because she wasn't innocent necessarily of the crime that happened and related to the murder. And maybe you could talk a little bit about her relationship to Owen Wilson's death.
It's Oliver Wilson.
Oliver Wilson, sorry.
She was connected to that murder. She never denied that. There came a time when she attempted to get away from Oliver, and he came after her and was arrested for assault with a deadly weapon. But he only spent one night in jail. And when he was so quickly released, the situation had only escalated. He threatened to kill her, her family, and she turned to her mother, you know, sort of asking, what do I do? And her mother said, well, I know these guys who are tough guys, local Crip gang members, and they can make him leave you alone. And so there came a night when Debbie and Oliver arrived at a park. These two guys came out and they took over. Debbie ran off and the two men ended up killing Oliver Wilson that night. So Deborah was prosecuted as if it was all her plan, as if she had hired these men to take out a hit on Oliver Wilson and that she did it for life insurance money.
Right.
So it was prosecuted as murder for financial gain, and that was why the prosecutors were able to say, we're going to get the death penalty against you. What they didn't say at the time was that they knew their entire case was bogus, that they had used an informant who had been involved in dozens and dozens of prior cases.
Mr. Dead Man.
Yes, his nickname was Dead Man. And
totally reliable in my mind.
And yet they just buried a whole lot of evidence that showed that they really did not have a case against Deborah. And they even went so far as to document the fact that they did not have their case, which
with the alibi memo.
Yes, there's right. This thing called the alibi memo where they basically put in writing, our witness is committing perjury. But we're not going to tell that to the other side. We're not going to tell that to the court. Well, 20 years after Deborah was sent to prison, these two young attorneys who volunteer to take her case, and they're actually land use lawyers by day, just right. doing this to try to do a good deed, they're the ones who, along with a private investigator, discover all of this buried evidence when they tried to just research and prove that Deborah was in fact an abused woman and should be able to present that evidence of abuse to the court now, since back in 1983, the courts and our whole criminal justice system didn't care very much about victims of domestic violence. Hopefully now the system cares more, but there still is I think, some work to be done and some light to be shined on these issues, and I hope that the film Crime After Crime does that.
Well, and Debbie's experience as a survivor of violence was so core to this case. I mean, he beat her with a bullwhip and, you know, went on to actually abuse other members of her family. And you paint this picture of her being in these really desperate situations, trying to make the best decisions as she could, as well as her family. And there was one line in the film where the person who was actually her co-defendant said he thought he was above this, but, you know, he was not above, like, the law of the ghetto. And that was a sense of people trying to make justice in a situation where justice was not being given to them.
That's right. That's right. Ramon Sibley, he's one of those two Crip gang members. And he says in an interview that I conducted with him in a maximum security prison that Oliver Wilson thought he was above all the law, whether it's the law of the land or the law of the street. And to him, it was unacceptable for someone to systematically, essentially abuse and torture not only another person, a woman, in this case Deborah Pegler, but I think what really crossed the line for him was the idea of someone doing those kinds of acts to a child. And what really motivated these two Crip gang members to attack Oliver Wilson that night was the fact that they knew that a young girl, Deborah's daughter, was being sexually molested by Oliver. That doesn't mean what they did was right. It doesn't mean it was justifiable, but it does change the way the court should look at a case like that. It certainly should change Deborah Pegler's own culpability or level of guilt and responsibility to what happened that night in 1982 was when the murder actually took place, and 1983 was when she was threatened with the death penalty and therefore had to take a plea to life in prison.
Hmm. That is the voice of director Yoav Potash, who is here discussing his new film, Crime After Crime. Now, Yoav, I actually wanted to go back because one of the things that I found really compelling about the documentary was the other characters that were there as part of her fight towards justice. And those are specifically the lawyers, Joshua Safran and Nadia Costa. Can you talk to us a little bit about their story, how they got engaged in this fight, and what their connection was to domestic violence?
Sure. So Joshua Safran and Nadia Costa are the two attorneys who volunteer to fight for Deborah Pegler's freedom after she's already been in prison for over two decades. And initially, they're doing it just to try to do a good deed. They believe that the case can be resolved in a matter of months, certainly under a year. But as it turns out, the case does stretch on for a number of years, and their own stamina, their own intellect is really put to the test. And one of my approaches as a filmmaker in making Crime After Crime was the idea that these people are really characters too. I've seen in other Get Someone Out of Prison films that usually the lawyers involved are sort of flat and boring. And in this case, I knew that I had two attorneys who were really compelling, each in their own right. Nadia is a marathon runner, kind of a super mom, overachiever, and she applies that stamina and that
sense of endurance.
Yes, maybe. Exactly. To this marathon of a case. Meanwhile, Joshua Safran is an Orthodox Jew, and he looks to Jewish tradition for inspiration and for fuel in fighting this long fight. So there's a particular prayer in the prayer book that talks about God is the one who frees the prisoners. And he interprets that as a religious duty on his part in his service to God to fight for justice, to fight for the release of those who are wrongfully imprisoned.
Now, Vanity Fair says this case is a bombshell in the lap of the L.A. District Attorney's Office. I wanted to ask you, how did you feel like your film ended up playing a role in Debbie's legal battle? And what do you think this really says of the DA's office in Los Angeles?
So that's right. The case is really – it's really based here in Los Absolutely. Angeles. That's where Debbie met Oliver Wilson. That's where the murder took place. And therefore, the whole court battle began here in L.A. And so it was prosecutors from the LADA's office who did prosecute Deborah unethically back in 1983. And so when these two new attorneys 20 years later find all the evidence that shows she was abused, one of the first things they do is they go to the LADA's office again, thinking, hey, it's over 20 years later. There's a new law. There's evidence they didn't know about. We're going to share that with them. We're going to see if they're willing to look at this case the right way now. And what actually transpired was Los Angeles District Attorney Steve Cooley met with them face to face, reviewed the evidence, and agreed. He basically said, you know what? You're right. This woman has been abused based on everything you're showing to me. I'm convinced. We're going to cooperate with you. I'm going to put in writing that we will help free Deborah Pegler. And he does that. He puts it in writing. What happens in the film that you see is he then decides to reverse that position before it can actually bring about Deborah Pegler's release. And his reasons for doing so appear to be quite shady and shallow, having to do with politics, both external politics and office politics.
And he has an odd set of cronies who help support his process, one of whom was an attorney who had slept with
a witness.
Right.
That's right.
And the other one that was like a key villain in one of the
McMartin.
Yes, exactly.
Famed most expensive failed prosecution in history at the time.
Right.
So my documentary reveals all of these misdeeds and the fact that Cooley really flip-flopped and reversed his own position on this case by putting his stance in writing and then deciding to completely reverse course and oppose Deborah Pegler's release from prison at all costs. So we did invite Steve Cooley to come to the Los Angeles premiere of Crime After Crime this Saturday night. It's a free screening. It's open to the public as part of the Los Angeles Film Festival. It's in downtown Los Angeles at California Plaza, the Grand Performances venue. We did invite Steve Cooley, or I should really say the Los Angeles Film Festival invited Steve Cooley, and he responded with a letter in which he once again grossly mischaracterized his role in this case. I have this letter here from him where he basically says that he tries to make it sound as if he had very little to do with this case. He says, in 2005, Pegler's attorneys made a presentation to some members of the district attorney's office. He neglects to mention that some members included he himself. Mm-hmm. And he also omits the fact that he did make this decision to help free Deborah Pegler. He did put it in writing. And it's no wonder why a Superior Court judge later ruled to kick the district attorney's office off the case, which is a very unusual ruling. But in this case, the judge found reason to say, you've gone way out of line here. So I think the film is going to cause quite a stir in Los Angeles.
Well, and I think beyond Steve Cooley, this film is really a testament to the fight of survivors to get justice. And for organizations and people that want to get involved, we're encouraging everyone to not only come out to the Los Angeles premiere screening at 8 o'clock Saturday, June 25th at Grand Performances on California Plaza, but also the film will be open in wider release in Los Angeles July 8th at the Lemley Theaters, both at Lemley Encino and Lemley Sunset. And you can get more information about the film and join the campaign, Yoav, at the website.
Yeah, it's just Crime After Crime. .com.
That's triple dub, crimeaftercrime.org.
.com.
Yoav, thank you so much for joining us today, and that does it for today's show. For today's subversive thought, we quote Toni Morrison, who said, "For me, art is the restoration of order. It may discuss all sorts of terrible things, but there must be satisfaction at the end. A little bit of hunger, but also satisfaction." You've been listening to Uprising. Martina Steiner is our assistant producer, Ankur Patel and Lex Henderson are our interns, and Teddy Robinson is our engineer. Listen to the show online and find links, local events, and other information we mention on air at uprisingradio.org. Sitting in for Sonali Kohatkar, I'm your host, Thane Mori Soundarajan. Thanks so much for listening.